Hello and welcome to the Reason Roundtable, the podcast of free minds, free markets, and free takes. I'm your host, Peter Suderman, and joining me today, we have our usual gang of esteemed panelists, Matt Welch, Nick Gillespie, and Catherine Mengu Ward. Everybody say hello.
Howdy.
Hi.
Hello.
Hello, that's great. Happy Monday, everybody. Today, we're going to talk about the Trump vibe shift, the drama at Doge, our favorite national emergencies, and what to make of Trump firing a whole bunch of inspectors general. Before that, however, a word from our sponsor. Let me tell you, if there's a surefire way to wake up feeling fresh after a night of drinking, it's with pre-alcohol. ZBiotics Pre-Alcohol Probiotic Drink is the world's first genetically engineered probiotic. It was invented by PhD scientists to tackle rough mornings after drinking. Here's how it works. When you drink, alcohol gets converted into a toxic byproduct in the gut. It's this byproduct, not dehydration, that's to blame for your rough next day. Pre-alcohol produces an enzyme to break this byproduct down. Just remember to make ZBiotics your first drink of the night. Drink responsibly, and you'll feel your best tomorrow. Their GMO technology, ZBiotics is continuing to invent probiotics that will help with everyday challenges of modern living. Go to ZBiotics.com/roundtable to learn more and get 15% off your first order when you use roundtable at checkout. ZBiotics is backed with a 100% money-back guarantee. So if you're unsatisfied for any reason, they'll refund your money, no questions asked. Remember to head to ZBiotics.com/roundtable and use the code roundtable at checkout for 15% off. Okay, so Donald Trump has been president for just 1 week, but already it feels like we are living in a different country. It's not just the flurry of executive orders, the upending of the federal bureaucracy. There is something else in the air, a new paradigm, a change in perspective, a societal sensibility shift. You might even call it a vibe shift. You can see this change in all sorts of ways. Cancel culture is flailing. You might even say it's been canceled. DEI is dying. Mark Zuckerberg is wearing boxy t-shirts and gold chains. Jeff Bezos has a box seat at Trump's inaugural. And Elon Musk is out there tweeting Keck memes while playing Diablo, running Doge, and building rockets and robots. Even the New York Times recently ran an extended interview with Curtis Yarvin, who is a sort of cult influencer amongst tech elites and self-styled neo-reactionaries. Yarvin defends monarchy, he criticizes democracy, and he warns about the overarching cultural power of what he calls, and what I think is his most useful addendum to the language, what he calls the cathedral. It's a catch-all term for the left-leaning, media, government, academia, coastal tastemaker class. The axis of evil, but for libs, right? And so the cathedral is inherently a kind of fuzzy, nebulous term, but primarily it's concerned with left-of-center cultural power and its influence on ideas and outlooks and worldviews, which is notable because the New York Times is in many ways the heart of the cathedral. And they're entertaining one of its biggest critics. I actually think when people say they hate the media, a lot of the time what they really mean is they hate a headline in the New York Times. But it's dawned on a bunch of commentators that under Trump, the right has, for the first time in many years, amassed real cultural power in what amounts to its own sort of cathedral of big tech, boosterish pro-Trump media, and presidential politics. Last week, Ezra Klein wrote in a widely shared piece for the New York Times, a piece asking why Trump's cultural victory seems so sweeping. On Substack, Matt Iglesias asked what the policy consequences of that cultural victory might be, and Nate Silver wrote a long piece wondering whether, per Trump's inaugural address, America would be entering a new conservative golden age. So, Nick, I want to start with you. What exactly is happening? Is there a real vibe shift? Is there a conservative moment in America? And if so, why is that the case?
First, I want to congratulate Curtis Yarvin on using Ozempic or some other kind of weight loss drug, because without that, without his more chiseled featured rather than his blobby persona, he's not going to be on the cover of the New York Times magazine. I think
that's a great victory for Maha, right?
Yeah.
Pharmaceuticals? I mean,
if you think Maha is not coming for your Ozempic after they get through all the red, red and yellow food dyes, I've got another... I think you've got another thing coming because there's no good evidence, long-term evidence yet. Maha will become a villain. It's already building up into being a return of a kind of Michelle Obama, you know, early teens lunch program thing. But the vibe shift, I think.
Alternatively, it's for health what Tipper Gore was to pop music.
Yeah, we can hope. We can hope, right? So I think that there is a not necessarily a vibe shift to a positive embrace of whatever Trump represents or people like the Nelk boys, the Canadian pranksters who have suddenly, you know, become people that we're supposed to take seriously. What we see, and this is important, and this is really important, was the complete dissipation of the cultural apparatus that brought the worst elements of the Democratic Party to power. And I think it's important that we get this right, that culture precedes politics. And it is not that Trump's victory changes the culture, but rather it reflects a long-term cultural shift that was already underway. And I think one of the ways to think about that is like, what was empowering the Democratic Party? You know, the worst elements of a kind of Democratic affiliated cultural power. And it was groups like Black Lives Matter, which just disappeared under, you know, in a haze of mismanagement, bad behavior, extreme positions that ultimately even people or especially people within that coalition were like, I'm not going to go along with an agenda, an overriding cultural agenda that, you know, reached into Sunday comics and every show on Netflix and everywhere else that said, I don't get to speak and I am part of the problem. Something happened with like the Women's March, which I think is also, it's interesting to think about these large scale cultural movements that had a moment and then faded. Politics picks that up last. There was a major, major miscalculation by the Democratic Party as a political organization to roll with the most extreme, least representative grievances among their broad coalition. So what we're witnessing more than anything else is the demise of that power. I think the question now, there is an immense opening. And from a libertarian point of view, as opposed to a conservative point of view, the question becomes, what do we insert into this conversation that is actually attractive and meaningful? People are not going to get behind a cultural agenda that is Jesse Waters on Fox News, shaming husbands who go grocery shopping, you know, with their wives. Candace Owens talking about how every Jew who are awful aren't even really Jews. They're Frankists and pedophiles. Tucker Carlson, who is popular now, actually talks about the rapture and about being possessed by demons and being scarred in his bed by demons and things like that. Benny Johnson of Turning Point USA, a recidivist liar and bad journalist, had Andrew Tate on. This is not the vibe shift that anybody in America is going to embrace wholeheartedly. What we have is the demise of a absolutely stultifying and oppressive left-wing Democratic Party-enabled cultural, you know, a security blanket being thrown on everything. What happens next is completely up in the air. And I think it has less to do with Trump per se than with these other elements just ultimately running out of all gas.
Matt, so Nick referenced something that we've been hearing for a long time from right-of-center provocateurs, in particular from, I think the first person I ever heard say this was Andrew Breitbart. This is the idea that politics is downstream from culture. And I sort of wonder how that plays into today's, sort of the rise of the MAGA cultural moment. And I want you to think about that in the context of a tweet from Meghan McCain that I'm going to read you here. I honestly never thought I would live to see the day when it was this culturally uncool to be a Democrat. As someone who has been socially ostracized for being a Republican my entire life, let me tell you, this is a brave new world out here. That kind of sounds like politics is upstream from culture, not downstream.
Here's a way of thinking about it, maybe, is that while we're in this moment where a lot of kind of center-left career political commentators are noticing a reality that Reason has been covering for more than 10 years and walking outside and saying, gosh, that sky is blue. Welcome to all of that. Meanwhile, it's interesting to reflect on the number of issues that Americans overwhelmingly believe and have long believed, and yet were on the wrong side of, according to the aforementioned culture that Nick was talking about, that tended to dominate. The last 10 years, beginning around 2014, it became this time where there was an ever broadening and ever deepening tax on what you could say. Everyone kind of understood the deal that if you said the wrong thing about gender pronouns, in my neighborhood, an admissions change policy in the local middle school system, you could be branded a racist or a fill in the blankist constantly. And so Americans just sort of learned what not to say, what to just sort of swallow your tongue out. Okay, whatever. It's not worth the hassle to do this. But meanwhile, the underlying policies, and some of these are being changed right now by Donald Trump, by executive order, were never popular. Affirmative action in the terms of racial preferences have been underwater for a really long time. It's like 70% of Americans say no. The term Latinx or Latine, it's 1 or 2% adoption or enjoyment by people who would be categorized under those terms. 70%, 67%, something like that of Americans. It's like, yeah, if you're born a male or a female, you should compete in that category. But a lot of these things, people understood that it wasn't worth the hassle to mention this. There's a cultural exhale that happens right now because Donald Trump is someone who says, I don't care. I don't play by those rules. I'll say anything, do anything. Maybe even less like he's our man, he's our champion. It's that he's absolutely an avatar of I'm not going to do it that way. And meanwhile, the actual elected Democrats in the Biden administration infamously and should go down in fame started to act on this in the era of COVID by adopting all of these explicitly censorious policies. Just today, this is a stupid example, but I have a YouTube channel in which old episodes of The Independents exist, the TV show that I did with Kennedy and Camille Foster back in 2014-ish. And there was an episode in which Kennedy was interviewing some woman who was sort of a vaccine denier and challenging her on it. We just got a takedown notice from YouTube because we're spreading COVID misinformation. There's all of this, and some of this was sort of directed or encouraged by the Biden administration. All the censoriousness of telling you what you can't say or think or believe, people got sick of that. We're Americans. We don't like that stuff. So I think that is a cultural and politics doesn't lead this. Politics does, at the end of it, cause the people who work in politics, like Meghan McCain, like Ezra Klein, like Matty Iglesias, like all these people, causes them to notice things. They all work in politics. I think the overwhelming thing here is a cultural response to being told what not to say, and people got sick of it.
Catherine, I have asked the two men on this podcast about the vibe shift, and they have not said
it. Well, we identify as men, okay? But
the two gentlemen on this podcast, and they have not said anything yet about the dudes and about the fellas. But this seems to be a big part of the narrative here. So Mark Zuckerberg, when he went on Joe Rogan and he had his boxy shirt and his chain on, he said that corporations had been culturally neutered and could use...
Nope, you already said what you said.
he said they had been culturally neutered and could use more masculine energy and that it would be good to celebrate the aggression a little bit more. There's a great feature published in an online magazine called The Point last week titled Lost Boys at the Beginning of History. And in this feature, the writer went to NatCon here in Washington, D.C. and met a bunch of dudes and talked to them about being men and having man feelings about Donald Trump. And one of the kind of funny subtexts of this piece is just like, occasionally at times they're just like, basically, I'd just really like to get laid. Like, it just sort of seems like that's like the, not even the subtext, just the actual text of some of this, even though they're definitely against porn, but they're pro-libido. They're pro-male libido. So, Catherine, I want to, like, give us some context about the male libido. No, about how it is affecting today's political cultural shifts here. Like, what Where's the masculine energy? Explain it to us.
Yeah, Catherine, you're a lady. Explain the male libido is the transition
now,
that
it?
I showed up on this podcast this morning to be a part of. So I think for sure part of the vibe shift is the return of a certain subspecies of masculinity in the public sphere. But that vibe shift has been shifting back since the 90s, right? And so I think that that actually is one thing about like the vibe shift, as we're talking about it right now, is a series of overlapping arcs of cultural change. And the war on boys industry, which was like incredibly robust in the DC think tank universe, like led by Christina Hoff Sommers and all those nice gals, that change started a long time ago. And maybe it is bearing fruit horribly in like the NatCon conference and Mark Zuckerberg's necklace and his like MMA habits. But I do think one, like this is more evidence of what Nick was saying, which is like the vibe shift is a long time coming and it has many arcs, it has many parts. And I think it would be the thing that is important about Trump in it is he has slowed, stopped, and reversed the encoding of the previous vibes in law.
Yes.
And that's the thing that we're against, right? The thing that we are against is locking in cultural moments with the force of law. And I don't trust Trump for one hot second to not lock in his cultural moment with the force of law in a minute. But right now he is rolling back some of the things that that came before him, and that is good.
So that you're very specifically referring to Trump's executive order, basically ending DEI programs in the federal government, saying it's not just you can't continue them, you can't rename them. And also, if I understand correctly, every single person who was explicitly employed directly in a DEI type role or office was put on paid leave as of Wednesday of last week. So that is a big shift, not just in the federal government, but also in places that get federal grants in federal contracting, right? Because a bunch of this is going to shift in the private sector to the extent that it has some sort of relationship to the federal government. Is that correct?
So, yeah, I think the other thing that's happening is, you know, Reason had a piece, I don't know, a couple years ago by Russ Green about the progression of ESG, so sort of corporate social responsibility, from individual companies doing it to voluntary industry standards to the law of the land. And this progression for me was like a very important thing to keep in mind, because there is a point at the beginning of that arc where you say like, listen, companies can do what they want. If you want to have a workforce that's, you know, entirely, you know, you do all your hiring based on like your candidate's carbon emissions, like feel free. But the sort of transition from the vibes are shifting and they might shift back and they might go somewhere we didn't even expect to now the SEC has an opinion about it. That is, I think, you know, in the rolling back of these DEI positions, that's there. I think it's fine that Meta has said we're not doing fact checking anymore and we're not doing DEI anymore. But that is
Well, they're not doing centralized fact checking. They've opened it up to a sort of a user community version of fact checking, just like on X, right?
But I think it is far, far, far more important that we're not locking in that status quo or the previous one in law.
Yeah. It's also important to note that corporate culture has changed. I mean, as Catherine's talking about it, and that the push against ESG over the past couple of years actually was coming from investment firms and things like that, because they also thought at the beginning of this that it would actually yield better returns for them and for their clients, and it absolutely did not. So there's an economic underpinning to a lot of this, these changes, where the revolt is coming, you know, not, you know, simply from, you know, like incels who are, you know, mad that they can't get laid. There's a broad-based understanding that for the kind of Democratic party of control overreach, which even when they didn't control the federal government, and I would peg it to starting in the middle of the Obama administration, where the federal government started taking over more and more functions and dictating kind of this is the way it's going to be done. You know, that just has not made people happier or better off. And it's alienated many people, because there are all of these little status pyramids that start to get encoded first in custom and then in law, which is saying like, me and my people get to dictate all the decisions. You are going to put your wheel to the shoulder, but you don't get to speak. I mean, we saw this in the Black Lives Matter movement. By the end of 2020, Asian Americans were pushing back against it because they were told you've got to show up and march in all the rallies and things like that, but shut the fuck up. We don't care about your grievances of America. And at the end of 2020, you saw a bunch of Asian American groups starting to talk about, you know, rises in hate crimes against Asian Americans, mostly perpetrated by Blacks. There's something about a zero-sum, top-down control, you know, version of social control as well as political control that people just push back against. And that's been happening in all sorts of different ways. And it's finally coming to government and the academy. Which are the two most hierarchical, slow moving, conservative in the deepest sense of the word places imaginable. So that's all good. It's good that the vibes are shifting. I think the question is, are they shifting? So it's going to be Andrew Tate, and it's going to be Joe Rogan, who has actually lost popularity relative to other podcasters. When you look at things like podcast charts, if this is the age of podcasts and it's a post mass media world, people like Jon Stewart, Pod Saves America, The New York Times, NPR, Travis Kelce's wife, they all have podcasts that are in the upper reaches of Spotify. So it's like, don't mistake Trump winning for an embrace of kind of a new masculinist, cultural shift.
Can we also talk about the thing that comes up every single time there's a change in who's in power or a perceived vibe shift, which is the side that feels that they are on the losing end starts to have this like insane vision of the hyper competence of the media and marketing savvy of the other side. And this is, it's like,
No one can stop the podcast, bros.
It is perfectly cyclical. Like whoever is out says it about the other side, and then whoever they come back in and they say it. But it's crazy every time. Like, of course, it is true that different people and different movements are mastering different media in an ever-changing way. But this, like, the reason the Republicans won is because the podcast bros and the social media something something conspiracy theory kind of top down imagined scheme. And like, meanwhile, with a mere functionally infinite amount of financial resources, the Harris campaign just couldn't figure it out. But, it's not their fault. It's the sinister Republicans with their plan to dominate. People used to say this during the Republican Revolution in the 90s. Yeah. It was like Newt Gingrich pulled all these think tanks from the ether. And, it just comes back over and over and over. It's just like deeply fundamentally wrong to think about it as a centrally controlled thing or even a coordinated thing almost all of the time, right?
Well, this goes back to Curtis Yarvin's complaint about the cathedral, which is that the other side controls all the mechanisms and all the levers of cultural power. And now we are starting to see complaints from the Democrats, from the left, that the right controls all the levers and the mechanisms of cultural power. And there was this incredible report in Bloomberg last week. It was like, we're going to map all the bro podcasts and show you that all the bro podcasts, They go on each other's podcasts.
No.
And they have some of the same guests. And sometimes they don't even talk about politics. They just talk about bro stuff. And what are we going to do about that? So actually, I want to tie this into the question about masculinity, but also about the tech bros. And Matt, you brought up Barack Obama.
You're a tech bro.
Yeah, you're not a tech bro. But but you remember Barack Obama giving a speech in which he, like the central line, the thesis of the speech was, you didn't build that. And part of his specific argument was, well, look, there's a kind of federal government, a sort of social layer underpinning everything that gets built, right? The government built the roads and funded the original research for the internet. But this has become, I think, sort of woven into left-leaning arguments over the last couple of years, the idea that individual accomplishment is not something to be praised and is not something that is good or even really happens. It's kind of fake. Like, it's always a group accomplishment. And I see in the new MAGA culture a desire to celebrate individual accomplishment and risk-taking. And I think that appeals to a lot of young men. And you see that actually in the piece that I mentioned in The Point, is that the guys are like, yeah, Donald Trump built something. He made something of himself. Whether or not you think that's nonsense, there is this kind of idea, I think, that you see with Elon Musk and with Sam Altman and sort of the great entrepreneurs of our time. This explains both the shift on the in the tech world, but also amongst young men who want to build something and say, yeah, I did that. And they feel like they have not been allowed to say that for the last 10 or 15 years.
I think there's a natural tendency, not just among young men, but people. I'm a universalist, Peter, of like, you want a dream. Catherine wants to go to Mars. It's cool. Get a rocket, right? And so that sense of hey, let's take some risks and do a thing that's cool, is fun. It's proactive. It's kind of American. And I think people are going to be gearing up for their 250th anniversary of 1776. And we're going to see more of this kind of content. And that's fine. I don't know how much of it is an explicit callback to Barack Obama. I do know that.
No, I'm not saying that they're specifically reacting to him. Just that idea got embedded in the liberal worldview.
I would say that the flip side of that Barack Obama thing, which is something that he would say over and over and over again, was that like, we used to build the Golden Gate Bridge. Now we don't do that anymore. And that was an opportunity to reflect. And again, we're seeing some of these center-left pundits discover 15, 20 years later, after they supported all kinds of government aggrandizing schemes, that, maybe we should think about how the government's not very good at building stuff. It's great. Welcome. One of the issues with a Golden Gate Bridge analogy is also that the Golden Gate Bridge was built largely by private actors. And so one of the great moments, actually probably the best thing about the Obama presidency on some level, and I had once had a hysterical fight with Lou Dobbs on Red Eye, the late great Lou Dobbs.
That sounds deeply, deeply funny.
About this, is that Obama gave the private space bros space to operate and to work, and that is sort of like the beginning of some of this. We're going to build some fancy stuff over here in the corner. And I think that's all to the good. The bad part about this is that also we're seeing this kind of sort of nationalism, sort of imperialism. People are really excited about Greenland all of a sudden, and let's make a lot of jokes about annexing Canada, and people are high-fiving, and we'll probably talk about it later, I would guess, but high-fiving Trump, just threatening everybody who looks at him funny with a 50% tariff, and just like, you know, we're America, suck it, is also can be part of that attitude. And that's an ugly, stupid attitude. It's self-defeating, and it is just as possible that it's attractive to our young men, who go to NatCon conferences. But it also should always be said that, as good as that one article that you pointed to was, it was a pretty good article. My God, if we have to listen to or read another article about the young men who go to conferences in and around Washington, D.C., I think we will get the government and the media that we deserve.
Can we pause here to appreciate the formal editorial rule at Reason? What is it, Peter?
No conference leads.
No conference leads.
You
we don't start articles
start
with conferences.
An article by describing something that happened at a conference.
We don't do that.
All right.
This also reminds me, and this is going to be a deeply absurd comparison, but I think it's legit. Trump sort of willy-nilly saying, oh, we're annexing Canada and buying Greenland and 50% tariffs for everybody. Like, America's power is funny to America and doubly funny to Trump, but it is not funny to the rest.
As hysterical as a red-eye flight with Lou Dobbs.
It is not funny to the rest of the world. Like, it's very, very serious business to the rest of the world. And one time, very shortly after Matt handed the reins of power to me at Reason, I sent a joking text to a staffer saying that he was fired for the misuse of a word. And he returned from lunch sweaty and panicked because he thought I had actually fired him. And that was the day that I learned that when you have power over people, don't make jokes like that. Don't fuck around.
That sounds kind of funny.
It was
name
funny.
Names.
But Trump is funny, too. And yet it's like poisonous and terrible. And I never, ever did that again because you don't want people living in fear anywhere.
So what I think here is that If you are a 20-something today, you have lived under a kind of liberal cultural hegemony for most of your life. So young people are just doing what young people do. They are rebelling against the cultural orthodoxy of previous generations, and they're doing it in their own way by calling everything Ohio and in some cases by supporting Donald Trump, who has riz, right? Like undeniable riz. It's like, yeah,
W riz,
right? See, I don't even know. I don't know because I'm not a 20 something, right? And Trump is the change agent who is available to them. It almost doesn't matter what policies he supports, which is why the policy aspect of this is so unclear, because whatever he is, it's not that. It's not the other thing. It's not the thing that they were raised under, right? And it's not the thing that they have been living under and in many cases feeling oppressed by, sometimes reasonably, sometimes unreasonably, because teenagers and 20 somethings are a massive contradiction and don't always do things reasonably, but they have felt oppressed by this for most of their lives. And he, Trump, is the avatar of absolutely anything else. And that is one of the reasons that we are seeing this shift to the right amongst young people. Let's talk for just a little bit here about one of these tech right bros, Elon Musk. Elon Musk is running Trump's Department of Government Efficiency, supposedly. And just to go back to what I was saying before, Musk isn't quite a young person, but he is absolutely hyper online, doesn't just own X, the website formerly known as Twitter. He seems to live and breathe in tweets and memes now. And Doge, in fact, is a reference to a decade-old meme featuring a very cute Shiba Inu, right? Wow, such budget, much efficiency, very waste. There have been some developments in Doge world this week. First, Vivek Ramaswamy, who was co-chairing Doge with Musk, has been given the boot. He is apparently going to go run for governor of Ohio, to bring it back to the teen slang. Second, Doge has found its home in government. It's been unclear exactly what sort of agency or organization Doge was going to be, whether it was even going to be formally part of the federal government or all an outside advisory group of some sort. But Doge is, in fact, just going to be a rebrand of the U.S. Digital Services, which will now be the U.S. Doge Service. And so the U.S. Digital Services is the forward-thinking tech agency established in 2014 under President Obama. Those two developments are related because it seems as if Ramaswamy was pushed out, at least partially over a dispute over how Doge would operate. Ramaswamy is reportedly wanted an organization dedicated to radically slashing spending, whereas Musk is apparently much more focused on building out technology to root out waste and make the government more efficient, right? Catherine, in the Elon Vivek split, is Ramaswamy on the right side of things? Do you worry about Vivek being pushed out here, or you just think this is funny because Vivek was apparently also quite kind of annoying?
Yeah, I wouldn't say the sentence "I am worried about Vivek Ramaswamy being pushed out" as a thing that I believe, but I do think that Musk's plan to like digitize the federal government and in so doing make it more efficient is just the latest in a very, 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 very long line of people who have had dramatic, real, important success outside of government coming to Washington with a plan to fix it. And they can't. They can't because Washington operates under its own rules and it is super, super close to outsiders. It is a priesthood. And Ramaswamy was a little more of a politician. He just was. He like sort of spoke that language and understood that world better. And I do think his version of just like getting out the knife and making cuts probably had a slightly better chance of success than whatever Musk is about to do, because I think Musk's solution will be too clever by half. But I think probably the things that will succeed within that agenda were going to be so idiosyncratic anyway that it's not clear that the specific guy at the head of it matters all that much.
Nick, this just seems like a rocky start for Doge. I know you have had high hopes for this. It is in some ways the most libertarian project, right?
It's my dream.
So what are your hopes here and what are your worries?
I miss Ramaswamy's fake but important commitment to cutting spending. Because at the end of the game, if we're spending $7 trillion a year and collecting, you know, $4.5 trillion a year, we've got big, big problems that will ultimately just choke out everything, you know, economically, culturally, socially, whatever. And Trump is not interested in cutting spending. He wasn't in his first term, and he's not going to be this time around. And now, if we're talking about government efficiency, more power to it. The fact that the Department of Education cannot get a working application for federal student aid up and running on any kind of reliable basis is an embarrassment that is far worse even than the Obamacare shitstorm and things like that. So yes, let's have better websites and better tech involved. The FBI under Louis Free spent over a decade of billions of dollars trying to modernize and kind of standardize its computer systems. Didn't get anywhere on it. These are bad things that need to change. This is not the DOGE that I think anybody is going to get amped up about. What we need is an explicit extended conversation, probably led by people more like Rand Paul than Elon Musk, who are saying these are the things the government should be doing, and here's how they're going to do them better. Here are the things the government has to stop doing, and that's the end of the conversation. So I don't have a lot of hope for DOGE at this point.
Matt, this isn't directly related to DOGE, but I do think it sheds some light on what's going on with DOGE and just the Trump administration generally. Trump is also touting another huge tech deal, which he calls Stargate. It's a $500 billion AI initiative featuring a whole bunch of tech luminaries like Sam Altman, who is the top guy at OpenAI, which does ChatGPT. Musk and Altman do not seem to get along very well. Musk has publicly criticized this deal. And when Trump was asked about Musk's complaints, he just responded, "But Elon, one of the people in the deal he happens to hate, but I have certain hatreds of people too." Just absolutely incredible.
Why is
Trump line,
suddenly
right?
talking like the Michael Keaton Batman?
If only.
Someone needs to.
Because Trump is the Michael Keaton Batman, right? A billionaire who like does weird stuff at night that we don't know about. It's in a bat costume.
Okay,
that's all. I'm sure he wears a cape. My point is, Matt. These are not just rich guys, right? They're very large personalities with their own agendas that are maybe not entirely related to Trump's. How do you think that affects DOGE specifically and the Trump style of governance, like what we can expect from the next 4 years more generally?
My instinct has been that at some point, sooner rather than later, Elon Musk will wear out his welcome in the inner Trump circle, just because in the ever widening competition of who could be the most online person alive. He beats even Trump because Trump does some presidenting as well and some rallies. Elon is out there giving speeches at AFD rallies in Germany or like piping in there and telling them to
explain
be cool. Explain
to listeners who don't know anything about German politics what AFD is.
It's a far right party described as far right and I think accurately anti-immigration. Some of the leaders associated with it, although they have since passed on, have said pretty explicitly racist and weirdo things. They have a lot more popularity than they did 10 years ago. They barely existed 10 years ago. And it's just not necessarily the place that we want to see someone who is anywhere close to the American government, the U.S. government, dealing with, let alone sort of rooting on, cheering on, and telling them about how they should think about Germanness. Just seems a little bit odd to me. So Elon's going to be talking a lot. I don't even know what artificial intelligence is, so I can't say at all what this $500 billion whatever is. But Elon has flappy gums, and the main thing that he has done for Trump has already happened. He helped donate a ton of money to his electoral campaign. He made it easier for people in Silicon Valley, including Sam Altman, who's a gigantic Democratic donor, to go Trump and kind of sort of the led a preference cascade. DOGE has been hamstrung already. The Vivek aspect of it was, we're going to write a bunch of executive orders that are tailored pretty specifically. If you look at the op-ed that they wrote together, co-wrote, but Ramaswamy is the one who wrote most of it in the Wall Street Journal. It was pretty interesting and pretty impressive. And also, they're not doing that much anymore. So I presume that this combination of effects will lead to, at some point, Elon Musk being marginalized. Trump will be irritated, as he frequently has gotten, including with Steve Bannon and other people who take too much credit for things. So it's hard to imagine a really long shelf life with Elon Musk just because he can't shut the hell up.
So we're going to close out this segment right now, and we're not doing segment titles, but I just want to say that if we were, this one would have been called Rendezvous with Ramaswamy. Okay, it's time for an advertisement. Hey, Reason Roundtable listeners, Peter Suderman here. Are you a student looking for a transformative opportunity that supports the foundations of a free society? Reliance College invites students aged 16 to 24 to the 2025 Great Connections Seminar in Chicago from July 26th to August 2nd. This year's theme, Reason and Free Will, dives into timeless ideas from writers such as Thomas Jefferson, Ayn Rand, and Aristotle. Students sharpen critical thinking skills in small dynamic groups, developing the intellectual tools needed to thrive in a free society. Outside the classroom, they'll explore Chicago's vibrant culture, touring museums, trying improv comedy with Catherine Mingu Ward. Nope, actually not with Catherine, but she does love improv comedy, and building lifelong connections. Parents, this program equips students to think, reason, and act independently. Go to reliancecollege.org/reason to learn more and apply. Early registration is just $400 before March 1st, including room and board with scholarships available. Don't miss out. Visit reliancecollege.org/reason to learn more and apply. That is reliancecollege.org/reason. All right, this week's listener question comes from Larry. With a new administration comes a new round of declaring national emergencies, allowing POTUS, that's the President of the United States, to sidestep Congress and assume temporary emergency powers to deal with the purported crises that are going on, not to mention continuing all the existing national emergencies and wielding those temporary powers too. What are your least favorite national emergencies that we're currently suffering under here in the land of the free and the home of the brave? And Larry helpfully provided us a link to Wikipedia, which says that there are currently 42 national emergencies in effect in the U.S. of A. Catherine, favorite national emergency?
It's hard to pick one when I love them all so much. I love them equally. I
don't believe that.
I would like to bring for our letter writer a national emergency declared by Bill Clinton in October of 1995, one day after my 15th birthday and your 14th, in which...
So like 5 years ago?
Yeah, 5 years ago. It was declared in response to Colombian drug cartels using American companies to launder money. It was a big emergency in 1995, and it is ongoing. That national emergency is current, according to Executive Order 12978. And I'm sure that it will come into play in our... current really smooth negotiations with Colombia.
So. Matt Welch, favorite national emergency?
Part of me really wants to say the blocking property of persons who threatened international stabilization efforts in the Western Balkans, just because, screw Albanian extremists in Northern Macedonia. However, the one I think that has more import is from September 14th, 2001. There are two bits of statecraft from that day that we still operate under. One is the authorization of the use of military force, which is open-ended. Eli Lake has written about that for us 15 years ago now, about why that's bad and should be stopped. And the other one is the declaration of national emergency by reason of certain terrorist attacks. Those terrorist attacks were really, really, really bad. It's not an emergency. That happens to us right now. And what that declaration of emergency allows the president to do is to otherwise sidestep otherwise limitations on the way that you can call up and mobilize troops, National Guard, and otherwise. It basically makes it more easy to manipulate our armed services and to mobilize them out. You think, hey, what's wrong with mobilizing armed services? Well, those protections or those previous rules were in there for a reason. And one of those reasons is that you don't want to demoralize the people who've volunteered and signed up for it. If you talk to military families, veterans themselves, in addition to being obviously very patriotic and willing to sacrifice themselves, they are stressed out and have been, even with the winding down of Afghanistan. We haven't started a lot of big new wars recently, but still Americans are out there everywhere. And this is a little bit of enabling, basically, legislation on an emergency that really was an emergency, but is no longer an emergency. Stop it.
Nick?
To follow up on a point Matt was making, I think the oldest still active executive order or emergency declaration goes back to Jimmy Carter in 1979, related to Iran. Iran's still an adversary and things like that. But so many things have happened since then. It's a reminder that these things should be term limited or sunsetted, just like all legislation. That would put us in a better place, or have to be constantly renewed. The one that bothers me the most that is currently in place is the one that Trump signed last week about authorizing the use of the military being deployed to the southern border. The fact is that the invasion, supposed invasion of, Mexicans and other undesirables flooding across the border had already ended a year ago for a variety of reasons. The idea of sending or making it easier to send troops there and all National Guard and things like that, it strikes me as following up at the end of something, showing up with reinforcements that are probably as likely to cause more new problems as they are to mop up any residual problems. So that one bothers me. And because it'll be on the books for another 100 years now or something.
All right. Speaking of things that bother us, let's do a Trump outrage lightning round. So one of the things that that is going to happen here in Trump's second term is he's going to do a lot of stuff and people are going to be real mad about it. There is going to be a lot of outrage, some of it for good reason, some of it not. There's going to be so much of it that we are going to have a hard time covering all of it on this show. But I do want to go around and talk about a couple of the first week outrages. Catherine, one of the things Trump did was he fired a whole bunch of inspectors general. He did it on a Friday night, which is when you do things where you don't want people to notice them because they're out drinking their Z-biotics already. What do you think about Trump firing a whole bunch of inspectors general?
I am of two minds. On the one hand, that was the only thing that a bunch of parts of the federal government had that sort of was already, in theory, dedicated to accountability and transparency. If Trump is serious, as he says he is, about reducing waste, fraud, and abuse, and otherwise shrinking the footprint of the federal government, feels like maybe IGs would have been allies in doing that. He did not get rid of all of them. And the ones that he got rid of are seemingly random. Like, it's actually really confusing what's going on. He left Michael Horowitz, who's the DOJ IG.
DOJ OG. No?
He's been there a while. It's true. So a well-functioning IG should be an ally in the fight against government waste and abuse.
Or at least a fellow traveler, right?
But they couldn't even be bothered to pick the lowest hanging fruit in a lot of these different departments. And so I think their loss will probably not be a blow to this effort.
Matt, there were several reports over the weekend that Trump had eliminated or stopped funding aid to Ukraine. And then there's some reports that maybe he didn't. We were talking about this in the office before the pod, and it was like, is this Schrodinger's Ukraine funding? We literally can't tell whether it's happening or not. And to observe it is to change the outcome of, like, what's going on with funding for Ukraine? Can you explain it to us?
I want to be clear. The beginning of this podcast, right before we went on the air, I just typed the word Ukraine into Google News to try and figure out what was going on. It's my full-time job.
One way of thinking about what Trump is doing is that a lot of his actions, including I think a more momentous one, which is suspending the U.S. Refugee program, they are 90-day until we can figure out what's going on things. And there are legal reasons to do this. This makes it more difficult to challenge it legally. He's learned from the lessons of the Muslim ban, which he did in the first week of the travel ban in his first presidency. And so if you do things for 90 days, this has been spelled out in the Volokh conspiracy, which we publish on our website too. So this is part of that. I think the suspension of foreign aid which is very interesting. And if you believe, like I do, and I think most libertarians do, that we should be giving just a tremendously less amount of foreign aid all around the world. It's a way for us to kind of like sort of try to manipulate the behavior of the recipients in the Middle East, especially, and elsewhere. Then that's kind of interesting. However, some of this foreign aid is also congressionally authorized. And so is the president just supposed to have a magic wand and say, even though you said this, we're not going to send that. So I don't know. The answer is, I don't know what's going on with Ukraine foreign aid, because there's only so many things that you can pay attention to in a Trump presidency. I presume that in the context of a negotiation that he's trying to put together to end the Ukraine war, that he is actually erring on the side of giving Ukraine more, or giving them more latitude, that just matches the noises that he has been making since being president and during the interim period before after the election, before he got sworn in. So I don't know. It'd be a nice time to rethink foreign aid altogether and to get rid of most of it. That said, Ukraine foreign aid is among the most popular, along with aid to Israel, that the U.S. gives among, according to us American citizens. We like that stuff.
Nick, since Matt is talking to us about using policy levers, threats, et cetera, to manipulate foreign governments, let's talk about Colombia, where over the weekend, a couple of plane loads of immigrant deportees were initially rejected by Colombia. Trump responded by threatening 25% tariffs. It looked like maybe Colombia was not going to back down, but as of this morning, they have backed down and said, you can send deportees here. And I guess that means there will not be tariffs. People are saying that this is sort of that Trump is making an example of Colombia. And so now he's going to be able to do this with countries all over the world. What do you think of this? And how do you sort of, is this an outrage, or is this just business as usual for the Trump?
I know my cocaine budget is safer now. So, you know, that's a good outcome. But, you know, it's not clear even with the Colombian thing, because there's diplomacy going on, which may be to Trump's point that I'm negotiating with people and things like that. He's also talking to El Salvador about taking a bunch of migrants that, you know, get kicked out of the U.S. Because Mexico may or may not be welcoming them back. For me, the outrage, and again, a lot of this stuff, we don't know exactly what's going on yet, because this has happened, but there have been reports that ICE agents are arresting people. They're showing up at workplaces. There was a big story coming out of Newark where they showed up without warrants and started arresting people. And this is deeply worrying to me, whether or not we start to see the end of due process, because there is a sense that certain things are emergencies, so that, you know, our normal operating procedure goes out the window. On a certain level, you don't change things if you don't do things differently, but there are, you know, real degrees in quality and kind in this. And, you know, to go back to what Matt was talking about with foreign policy, one of the things that I think Trump will do well and has been doing well is in foreign policy, where he is pushing to force a change in status quos that are not really tenable, including in places like Ukraine, to the extent that the Middle East is shifting. You know, I'm sure part of it is Trump pushing to accelerate something to get to the next stage. It may not always be better, but it will be different. And in that sense, I think it's to be applauded.
Catherine, I want to ask you something totally different here about another untenable status quo, and that is the public school system. It's School Choice Week. Do you want to say something?
It's School Choice Week. School choice is really important. And I think that in the noise of the early Trump administration, it could be easy to forget that while a plane load of deportees to Colombia are a bargaining chip, and of course, there are real human lives at stake there, there are things that like regular Americans care about every single day, and that is where their kids are going to go to school. Donald Trump's good on school choice. He's always been good on school choice. He's always said the right words. He has the people who are serious about school choice speak at his events. I am cautiously optimistic that his administration will do what the federal government can do to expand school choice at the K-12 level, and that would be great. That would make me feel slightly less grumpy.
Maybe school choice will be part of the vibe shift. Matt Welch, what have you been watching or consuming this week?
So I, in my never-ending dive into Revolutionary War 1776-related stuff, I was just flipping around looking for my next documentary and noticing that there isn't really all that much about George Washington, strangely enough. So I finally found one the History Channel put together. It was a three-part miniseries in 2020 called Washington. It was executive produced by Doris Kearns Goodwin. It's got talking head stuff from the... It's basically a B version of a Ken Burns documentary, less slope panning and banjos, and more historical recreations with actors that you don't recognize. You know what I'm talking about, right?
A lot of Fife music in the background.
No, they really didn't. They didn't hit the music as hard as they could have, and no rap battles either, which is sorely disappointing. But narrated by Jeff Daniels, you got Bill Clinton in there. Colin Powell is pretty interesting, especially when he's talking about Washington having to hang the odd mutineer here and there and try to impose discipline on his army and some of these sort of troubles. John Avlon is a talking head, and he's actually pretty good in there too. It'll pass the time for you as a documentary. It's got some pretty decent stuff.
That's an incredible recommendation. It'll pass the time for you.
You know what? What it reminds me of, as all the Revolutionary War era reading does, but this expands beyond that. The Revolutionary War is about 40% of the three-part series, is how many different times the revolution writ large, before and after, including the war, sort of hung on a knife's edge or could have gone a different way. And Washington is in the middle of quite a few of those things, including stuff that's probably old hat to everyone, but it's good to get a refresh of towards the end of the war. A lot of his military leadership's like, let's go to Congress and tell them, you better pay us right now or else there's going to be some trouble. And Washington made a very persuasive, ultimately, point to say, like, no, that's again, we can't just dictate to legislators. That is against what we've been fighting for this whole time. Obviously, him leaving after two terms in office and his farewell address and such like are moments in which he insisted on a kind of anti-imperial republicanism that is sorely lacking in modern American civic life. So it's a good refresher on those things, as well as just what a horrendous early career he had in the French and Indian Wars.
If you want a musical rendition of George Washington's life, just Google George Washington song, Brad Neely. There's a 2-minute and 20-second animated YouTube song about George Washington. It's one of the funniest and greatest things on the internet. I'm going to put it in the show notes, but you owe it to yourself to listen and to watch, especially if you like things that are funny or interesting, or you care about George Washington, it'll pass the time for you. Nick, what have you been watching?
Final point on George Washington. John Avlon's book about Washington's farewell address is magnificent. His farewell address was one of the most widely reprinted speeches in American history throughout the 19th century. It fell out of favor when the progressive movement took over, precisely because it limited the size and scope of the government. And it is so contemporary. Both Avlon's treatment as well as the speech itself is phenomenal. I went to see one of the very last performances in New York City by the Blue Man Group, which has been, which started in the Lower East Side in the late 80s and has been performing at the same theater near NoHo, basically near the Lower East Side since 1991. Watching it, this was part of a broad shift, a vibe shift in the 80s about cultural things, where things that were downtown or alternative ultimately became mainstream, and the mainstream kind of disappeared. You know, we talked recently about David Lynch's passing. This is all part of a broad movement. And it was kind of wonderful to see one of the last bits of, one of the last performances by the original Blue Man Group people. and to recognize that it had kind of done its cultural work and it was time for something new to replace it. It's now owned by Cirque du Soleil, so it's gone through various types of changes, and it'll still be appearing in places like Las Vegas, Orlando, and Boston, as well as Berlin. But the Blue Man Group is so innovative. It is so optimistic. It is a commentary on, you know, kind of what is possible in American culture. It created a whole new vernacular, a way of talking about possibilities. The blue men are aliens from outer space who come and are kind of bemused and amused and inspired by Earth. A tremendous experience. And I would recommend that people go see it where it's still around. But it is, you know, it's one of the great things, kind of like in New York, the dance kind of review Stomp was like this, as well as plays like Sleep No More that, you know, also both have stopped performing after decades. And it's kind of like, okay, we're now in a post-Cold War era of culture and cultural innovation. What comes next? So, you know, and that's an exciting place to be. But the Blue Man Group is fantastic.
I had a real recommendation, but I'm going to pivot and say instead the name of the newly announced initiative Stargate has put me in mind of the show Stargate SG-1.
Not the movie?
Not the movie.
The Kurt Russell, James Spader movie from the 90s.
The show.
The best decade.
The show. It started in 1997, aired through 2002, and y'all, it was good. I'm just going to say, like, speaking of things to pass the time, if you have enjoyed really any of my recommendations on this podcast in the past in the sci-fi arena, you should watch this show. This should be a show that you just have on sometimes in the background while you're doing the dishes. It is, you know, an elite team of U.S. military personnel who go in and out of Stargates that allow them to travel around the world, or around the universe. Everywhere they go, weirdly, looks like British Columbia. It looks like Vancouver, because it always is Vancouver. And
Battlestar Galactica, the rebooted version, had that exact same problem.
Vancouver every time. You know, they are not that competent and not that heroic. And I think that that is something that I really like to see in my U.S. government-sponsored sci-fi adventurers, and that we should have more of. It's kind of like a workplace comedy that happens to have interstellar travel and Egyptian gods as aliens. It's just good. Stargate SG-1. You should watch it.
Now I want my recommendation to be Stargate the movie.
The movie's good too. The movie's obviously good, but like the show is where it's at. It has Buffy the Vampire Slayer energy, if that's what you want, and you should want that.
So I've been watching a show that predicted, in some ways, the vibe shift. It is Landman, and this is part of the Taylor Sheridan expanded universe. It is a show about an oil worker in Texas. The main character is played by Billy Bob Thornton in absolute, just like, don't give a flip mode, monologuing his way through every single episode while drinking light beer and trying to avoid, like, billionaire jerks and his crazy wife and daughter and also a whole crap ton of like weird stuff in Texas, including cartels and rattlesnakes and lawyers and Lord knows what else. And I don't know if I like this show. There are things that are good about it, things that are less good about it, but it's well executed for what it is. It also has a bull mastiff in it starting in episode 5 of season 1. That's a big deal for me and my dogs, since all of my dogs have been bull mastiffs. But what really stands out to me about this show and Yellowstone, and that I've been thinking about a lot lately, is that Taylor Sheridan is in some ways the sort of poet dramatist of the Trump MAGA vibe shift, like of that era. If you look at Yellowstone and the way that it, like the virtues and values that it that show was built around, a sort of success in business, but also family, also this sort of intensely conservative attachment to land and to sort of the generational properties of land, of like, it's not just mine, it's my father's and my grandfather's, and this is the place that I have been, right? That sense of place. But also, you see that in Landman, which is not as much a show about sort of land and a family in a family dynasty in the same way, but is very much a show about the Trump coalition. And in particular, in the first episode, we are introduced to a crew of roughnecks, of kind of blue-collar workers who work on oil rigs. And most of them are Hispanic, and some of them are sort of downscale white guys. And they are all making six figures working on oil rigs, but also like living in these sort of crappy trailer situations, right? But like, these are the guys who went for Trump in the most recent election. And this show was written before the election, right? So it's not a reflection, it's not happening afterwards, but it kind of captured that and captured that scene in a way that you just don't see on television very much. I don't know if I really love this show, but the monologues are pretty great, and I do love monologues. And there's a weird way in which this show actually recalls a different era of television in a sort of inverted way. This Taylor Sheridan's work is basically just Aaron Sorkin, but for the populist middle of the country, because all of his shows are just shows about like pretty smart, pretty competent dudes walking around telling you how it is. And there's like a bunch of snappy dialogue and like banter, and then it always resolves in like a big monologue that just makes that point. And like somebody owns somebody else with a bunch of verbiage. And if you like that sort of thing, as I did when it was in the West Wing, and as I still do when Billy Bob Thornton is doing it to the liberal lawyer lady in Landman, well, Landman is probably a good show for you. All right, that is our podcast for this week, folks. Nick, do you have anything you want to tell us about that's coming up in New York? Any events we want to advertise here?
Yeah, we've got a great event on February 27th with Reason's own Brian Dougherty talking about his book about modern libertarianism. Go to reason.com/events to get the latest on all that, and go to reason.com/newsletters and sign up for the NYC newsletter to get the latest and greatest coming down the pipe.
Awesome. And while you're going to reason.com, you should also go to reason.com/donate and give us your money. Your donations make this show and everything we do here at Reason possible. That's reason.com/donate. Give us your money and stay tuned. Come back, listen to us again next week.